Welcome to Interviews for Resistance. Since election night 2016, the streets of the U.S. have rung with resistance. People all over the country have woken up with the conviction that they must do something to fight inequality in all its forms. But many are wondering what it is they can do. In this series, we'll be talking with experienced organizers, troublemakers, and thinkers who have been doing the hard work of fighting for a long time. They'll be sharing their insights on what works, what doesn't, what has changed, and what is still the same. I am Sarah Jaffe, your host.
Greg Kassar, and I am a city council member in Austin representing District 4.
All right. So a lot of things have been going on in Texas this week. Wanted to briefly start off with talking about Hurricane Harvey and the outlook for Texas. I know you're not that close to Houston because it's a massive state, but talk about what's going on in the state in terms of recovery efforts.
Well, the devastation in Houston has been tragic and enormous. You know, we're still are learning about the scale. I myself grew up in Houston. Our state, you know, everybody knows someone or multiple folks mm-hmm. that were affected by the floods, and we're still, you know, mourning the deaths here in Austin. A lot of folks are stepping up. Many people have chartered their own buses to bring people here from the Gulf Coast, to have gotten their own rafts and boats to go and save people themselves. The city of Austin has sent first responders and medics and aid, and we just signed a lease for a mega shelter to house probably likely about 2,000 people here in the coming days that are being evacuated from across the state. It has been a very hard time for folks here in Texas, but at the same time, you know, we have all had a chance to also recognize each other's collective humanity, and everyday Texans have been helping strangers, have been opening up their homes and their hearts and their wallets. There's been really inspirational collective action even in the devastation. Also, I think it's really important to note, since we're talking about immigration and immigrants, that you know, Houston is one of the largest homeless undocumented folks in the country. It's by many counts the most diverse city in America, and there are many undocumented people who will not be eligible for any FEMA direct cash assistance because our government has continued to label folks as criminal, as undocumented, instead of recognizing their collective humanity the way that we should, and the way that we've started to recognize because of the human suffering over there.
Yeah, one of the things that people commented on a lot was the question of whether immigration checkpoints were still going to be in effect while people were trying to evacuate ahead of the storm.
Yeah, you know, and we were back and forth answers about that, I'm sure caused more suffering and damage to those undocumented families. You know, I was actually at a shelter here in Austin, one of our smaller shelters, the night of the 28th, on Monday, and I heard firsthand from folks what is becoming common knowledge across the state, which is many families that are evacuating the coast are scared of coming to our government shelters. They're scared that their immigration status might be checked, that they'll be targeted in their moment of need. Austin police are not checking immigration status at our shelters, but I understand why people are afraid. You know, Greg Abbott and Donald Trump have created that fear, and they've consistently imposed that fear on immigrants in our community.
Yeah, and it's being a progressive elected official in Texas, I'm sure you deal with a lot of people who make some frustrating arguments about this. And so looking forward, I mean, it's obviously too early to say what the rebuilding is going to look like, but how do elected officials in Texas, how do people who care about what happens to people keep an eye on the process and make sure that, you know, people who may not be U.S. citizens still have access to help and rebuilding and the support they need to get through this?
You know, I hope that, you know, the communities in Port Arthur and Rockport and Houston, you know, can be really involved in the the decisions being made by their governments and their communities. Here in Austin, when we had some massive flooding, there was additional city supplemental support city funding and city debt that was issued to help with our own flooding issues in the past. And oftentimes the guidelines, the government guidelines for city funding was just mirrored off of federal guidelines, which would have excluded undocumented folks from lots of assistance. And we were able as a city to rewrite those because we don't have to follow the same kinds of rules the federal government sets. We can set our own rules. And so I think that that's going to be, you know, really important in these communities that are so diverse. There should be no question that the folks that are going to be rebuild cities like Houston are largely going to be undocumented workers.
Right.
You know, there's study after study showing that at least half of Texas's construction workforce is undocumented, and that's the number of people that are willing to report to a researcher they don't know their immigration status. So likely the numbers are significantly higher than that.
Yeah, and if we know anything from what happened in Katrina and elsewhere, it's that especially with the conservative administration in the White House, they're going to be looking for the cheapest labor they can possibly find.
Yeah.
So we were also here to talk about something slightly less depressing, although it's an ongoing fight. So tell us about the struggles on the latest nasty anti-immigrant bill in Texas.
Yeah, so 2 days ago, federal judge Garcia declared that the major provisions of the anti-immigrant Senate Bill 4 are unconstitutional and unlawful and are blocked from going into effect. Thanks to that court ruling today on September 1st, that discriminatory law has been stopped in its tracks, and I'm really grateful not just for the judge's ruling, but most importantly for the enormous statewide organizing effort that was led by immigrant organizers and themselves to fight Senate Bill 4 every step of the way, from the legislature to our city halls, where the movement pushed city council after city council, not in every major metropolitan area in the state, to sue, along with in small towns, be they bedroom communities, be they college towns like San Marcos, or be they, you know, cities, little town cities on the border, all joined together to successfully block the you know, all the most substantial provisions of the law. So that ruling has brought some real relief to everyday families. You know, on Wednesday morning, I was, you know, receiving phone calls and talking to constituents that were asking for access to a lawyer, or asking if they need to find a way to sell their house in the month of September, because if they got deported, would they get a chance to sell their house?
Right.
And then Wednesday night, you know, folks were in tears and celebrating. And so they bring some much needed relief, but I think much more importantly, it is a glimmer of hope about what collective action can do even in the state of Texas, and how grassroots organizations can successfully oppose the agenda, the anti-immigrant agenda of some of the most powerful people in the state.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit more about what this law would have done were it able to go forward.
I'd say that there are three most critical parts of the law. The first one is that it would have mandated that Texas sheriffs honor all federal deportation requests, called detainer requests, which essentially hold people, immigrant people, in jail because they are immigrants for longer than they should be held in jail so that they can be deported. That provision was blocked, and that was a critical provision in the law. And that allows sheriffs, like our sheriff here in Travis County, which covers Austin, to continue her policy of not unconstitutionally holding people. And it opens up the opportunities for organizers to organize in more than other 200 other Texas counties to get those counties to follow their lead. Because those sheriffs oftentimes have held up the state as an excuse for the reason they can't protect people's constitutional rights. But now with this ruling, organizers can push those sheriffs to do the right thing. At the same time, I think it bears acknowledging that those sheriffs, this ruling does not stop those sheriffs from working with ICE, but it creates the opportunity for organizers to move them. A second critical provision of the law is that it would have put in coercive requirements that would force police, local police, to act as deportation agents. And again, this ruling clarifies that police cannot arrest you for being an undocumented person, and they cannot prolong your arrest and keep you in the police car in order to hand you over to ICE. Both of those are violations of people's basic rights, and that part of the law was gutted. The judge did say that police could ask about people's immigration status, but he stated that they can't ask about it based on racial profiling, and it's very difficult to think of situations where a police officer could ask somebody about their immigration status without profiling them. And the judge clarified that that nobody actually has to answer that question. And because if you don't answer it, you can't be arrested for it. And if they did ask and the person did answer, or even if you voluntarily offered up your immigration status, that police officer is not allowed to arrest you or hold you for it. So it essentially guts those provisions of the law. And then the third portion is, you know, it threatened to remove elected officials like myself from office for even endorsing a policy other than Senate Bill 4. So even for just publicly and individually opposing the law, it threatened to remove elected officials from office, and that portion of the law was blocked as well.
How would that even work? It's like...
We asked that question in the lawsuit, and I think the judge asked me.
I guess the answer is it wouldn't.
Yeah, so it wasn't just removing people from office, but also imposing Class B misdemeanors, which could lead to up to a year in jail time, and $25,000 a day penalties, which adds up into millions of dollars in fines per year to local jurisdictions. So, you know, an extremely coercive law that was trying to force sheriff's departments and police departments to act as deportation agents. Ultimately, those provisions were effectively blocked, and now local organizers can push police departments and sheriff's departments to do the right thing.
Yeah, wow. Seems like all these right-wing claims to be concerned about free speech would have been a little concerned about that. But, wait, that's not a thing.
Oh, wait.
That's not real. So you come from an organizing background yourself before you became an elected official, right?
That's right. I was our, you know, policy director and organizer, corporate campaigns organizer at Workers Defense Project, which is our local immigrant worker center.
Yeah. And so talk a little bit about some of the organizations that have been really working on fighting this. I think I saw pictures even today of another march against this bill. So it seems like people are really still committed to fighting this until it's completely dead. But tell us a little bit about some of the organizations that have been involved in stopping this.
Yeah. This has become a statewide issue, and so there have been statewide calls by organizations for all local elected officials to join in on this lawsuit. And what I think was really important and special about this moment was that community organizations on the ground, like Texas Organizing Project and Workers Defense Project and United We Dream, were on the ground demanding that local elected officials stand up and fight back and sue. There were grassroots attorneys that were advising those organizations through their work, and Local Progress, which is the national network of progressive local elected officials, set up infrastructure in Texas to coordinate progressive city council members and county commissioners to play sort of an inside-outside game, to be active, to stand with the activists, but also work on the inside to move the rest of their local governments to join this lawsuit. And I think if you read Judge Garcia's opinion, it becomes so clear that that both the overwhelming damage the overwhelming damage that SB 4 could have caused, that community members themselves raised, was critical for his decision, but also what was critical to his decision was how many jurisdictions and municipalities stated that there could be irreparable harm caused by the law to those jurisdictions' safety and well-being if the law went into effect. So I think it was really critical that we had both grassroots organizations, like United We Dream, Workers Defense, and TOP, and an organization like Local Progress helping to coordinate something that had never been done in the state of Texas before, which was, you know, local governments all joining together to sue the governor and the state on immigrants' rights and social justice issue like this one.
Yeah. It
wasn't just like the mayor sweeping in to save everybody, right?
Right, yeah. Yeah, I think it's interesting to point out that, you know, legal decisions don't happen in a vacuum, but that they actually happen in the context of organizing and pressure. And we've seen that several times since the beginning of this administration alone.
That's right. And oftentimes, right, you will just have individual plaintiffs go out on a limb on their own, or one city file a lawsuit and the other cities can say that other city has it handled. And in this case, instead, the leadership came from the people and then the politicians had to follow.
Yeah. And so what, since this, this seems to have been a pretty successful coalition here, what groundwork has this laid for going forward in Texas?
Yeah, there's, I think that at its core, SB4 is about division and criminalization of communities of color, and ultimately the dehumanization of communities of color. So ultimately what's at SB4's root is at the root of so many of the other battles we're facing with the Trump administration and with the Abbott administration. So I think this has laid really important groundwork for us to talk about fighting mass incarceration, fighting mm-hmm. against anti-transgender bills like the bathroom laws, because right. ultimately this is a coalition that is based around the idea that no one is illegal, no mm-hmm. one is inherently criminal and bad, that we all have these basic human rights, and I think that motto does not just translate to the immigrants' rights movement, but rather is an important statement about how we need to fight mass criminalization as a tool of oppression, lift up movements that are fighting against not just deportation, but also things like mass incarceration and unconstitutional policing.
Yeah. Yeah, there was, I remember you guys had a fight over another one of those bathroom bills in Texas this year as well, right?
Yep. And we barely got away with it not passing. But I think there was obviously lots of also really great organizing done on the ground by LGBTQ activists that ultimately was successful this time around, but it will be back next legislative session.
Yeah. Seems like there are a lot of lessons that people around the country could take from Texas about surviving under Trump.
Yeah, we've been in this situation for a while. But it is definitely worse to have the governor of the second largest state in the country that is in sync and in line with the federal government on deporting folks who are a political problem for him. And
right.
so there is certainly even more urgency here under the Trump administration, but I think the SB4 battle is a symbol of hope around the possibility of collective action, even in a state like Texas or even in a country under Trump, where mm-hmm. immigrant communities, folks who are not even allowed by our government to vote, can organize and galvanize a community to stop somebody like Governor Abbott's top priorities.
Yeah. And last, so as we're talking, there's sort of we're still in limbo around whether Trump is going to repeal the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals DACA program for young people that are often known as Dreamers, people who came here as children. And so wondering, sort of looking forward to the potential of that, what kind of groundwork have y'all been laying down there to deal with that, possibility?
Our Dreamers are organizing and we are standing beside them to push Congress to pass a bill that gives relief to Dreamers to put funding for deportation defense in our city budgets and to continue to organize across cities in models similar to what we did on SB4 because ultimately it's going to take the kind of collective action that got us the SB4 injunction to ever get comprehensive immigration reform, to ever get a DREAM Act passed. And so, our Dreamers have unfortunately faced the threat of deportation in the past before DACA, mm-hmm. and they themselves stood up, told their stories, and fought and won DACA. And if it comes to pass that DACA is repealed, we will will mourn its loss, and it will be devastating. But you know, all we can do is not let them win.
Excellent. And how can people keep up with you and with some of these organizations?
You can, my Twitter is at Greg Kassar, and I've also got a Facebook page that we try to keep pretty active, and then you can follow the social media for Workers Defense Project, Texas Organizing Project, and United We Dream.
Interviews for Resistance is a project of Sarah Jaffe with assistance from Laura Faillebois and support from the Nation Institute. You can find more information at necessarytrouble.org. Thanks for listening.